Coming up, we're going to hear Munther Isaac, who is a Christian pastor in Bethlehem in the West Bank of Palestine, and then part of a debate by Mehdi Hassan. He's going to explain that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. This is a debate he did in Canada. And finally, we're going to hear an interview with Columbia professor Jeffrey Sachs about the nature of the deep state and how it is related to the war in Ukraine. So here is Munther Isaac.
I'm calling for repentance from Christian Zionism. And I want you to try to understand Zionism or Christian Zionism from the perspective of Palestinians. Try once to explain Christian Zionism to a Palestinian. Try to persuade him. Well, you know, I know you've been living in this land for generations upon generations upon generations, but there is this God who promised your land to someone else. Accept it, live with it. This is what Zionism is teaching. And in fact, it becomes our fault for not accepting this idea that your God gave you our land. This is what Zionism is teaching. And then we're forced to debate the Bible. Look, read the Bible. Show me one other context in which a dispute is solved by someone referring to what their God told them. Is this really how we solve things? And you have to understand that, you know, when they refer to it as a struggle, when we talk as Palestinians about our land, this is not a political statement. This is land we've inherited and farmed for generations upon generations and upon generations. And then you show up from Europe and you tell us God gave us this land thousands of years ago, and we have to accept it, really. But what is Zionism and Christian Zionism is saying also is that some people are special. God made a special deal with those people. He favors them, and we have to accept it. It's colonialism in which the colonizers say, our God gave us your land, and if you fail to accept it, shame on you. It's the concept of a tribal God, maybe even a racist God, who shows favoritism, a partial God. And when you support a tribal God or a racist God in this way, then also violence is justified and accepted. So today we have to call Zionism and Christian Zionism for what it really is. Zionism established a homeland on someone else's land. This is what Zionism is. Israel was literally established on the ruins of our towns and villages. The Zionists literally store our homes. I'm talking about physical homes with keys. We still hold the keys. They live in them. They kicked us out of our land. 800,000 Palestinians became refugees. And in fact, Israeli historians describe it as ethnic cleansing. This is Zionism. And then Zionism established a state, which is clearly a racist state, because it is a racist ideology. The concept of a Jewish state is by definition exclusive. And finally, you know, a few years ago, the nation state law said explicitly.
And that was Pastor Munther Isaac from the Christian Church in Bethlehem. Next up is Mehdi Hassan. He is going to explain to us, this is during a debate that took place in Canada, he's going to explain why anti-Semitism is not the same as anti-Zionism. And finally, we'll hear Jeffrey Sachs, professor at Columbia University in New York, will explain how the deep state is related to the war in Ukraine. So here is Mehdi Hassan.
Hassan's opportunity to present the con side of the argument.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. In 1917, over 100 years ago, Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, a card-carrying anti-Semite, a man who had denounced the evils of Jewish immigration into the UK, a man who referred to Jews as an alien and hostile people, he issued his Balfour Declaration, which promised a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. It was the first time a major world power had come out in favor of Zionism, which at the time was a pretty new and pretty controversial movement, calling not just for a Jewish homeland, but for the building of a Jewish majority state in Palestine. And yet, the only Jewish member of the British cabinet at that time, a man named Edwin Samuel Montagu, adamantly opposed both Zionism, which he called a mischievous political creed, and the Balfour Declaration, which he referred to as anti-Semitic and a rallying ground for anti-Semites in every country in the world. The only Jewish member of the British cabinet, that is what he said. And yet tonight here in Toronto, over 100 years later, we are being asked to vote for a motion that would damn Montague as the anti-Semite while praising Balfour as the champion of Jews and Judaism. That's ridiculous. In fact, this entire motion tonight is ridiculous, disingenuous, ahistorical. It says, be it resolved, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. It doesn't say some anti-Zionists engage in anti-Semitism, which I don't disagree with. It doesn't say some anti-Semites hide behind the cloak of anti-Zionism, which again, I don't disagree with. Everything Douglas listed about what's happened in Toronto, disgusting, reprehensible. Those people are shameless bigots. But that's not what the motion says. The motion says anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. No ifs, no buts, no caveats, no exceptions. Anyone who takes an anti-Zionist position is automatically, inherently, unavoidably anti-Jewish, an anti-Semite, a racist. That is what you would be voting for if you make the mistake of voting for this motion tonight, which I'm sure you won't do because you are far too smart and nuanced an audience to do that. You are Canadians! And I have great respect for Canadians. I say that for no apparent reason whatsoever. I like Canadians. I like Israelis. My debate partner tonight, Gideon Levy, Israeli writer, is one of my journalistic heroes. It's a privilege to be on the stage with him. But this debate fundamentally at its core, and I kind of agree with Douglas here, it's not about Israelis. It's not about Israel. It's not about Gaza. And by the way, on the subject of Gaza, given Douglas gave us some math about the death toll on October the 7th, horrific death toll, which we all condemn, I would remind you also that the death toll inflicted on Gaza, the deaths and injuries in Gaza are the equivalent, if we're going to do the ratios, of 2 million Canadians. 2 million Canadians. But that's not what the debate is about. It's not even about Zionism itself. It's about the legitimacy of anti-Zionism, whether you can be anti-Zionist, opposed to Zionism, which, remember, is a political ideology, a nationalist movement, not a religion, not a race, not a protected class, whether you can be anti-Zionist without being smeared, tarred, demonized as an anti-Semite. And I want to be clear tonight. You could be the most pro-Israeli person in this room tonight, the most proud and ardent Zionist here, and still vote against this motion with a clear conscience. Still vote with our side, the right side. Because this motion is not about whether you are pro-Israel or pro-Zionist. It's about whether the rest of us have the right, the freedom, to take a different view on Israel, on Zionism, on Benjamin Netanyahu even, without being silenced, without being told we're racists. We're not. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. I'll tell you three reasons why you should oppose this motion tonight. Number one, if you vote for this motion tonight, you are throwing logic, history, and the English language under the bus. Because anti-Semitism is hating Jews, the people, and Judaism, the religion. Anti-Zionism is opposing Israel, the state, and Zionism, the ethno-nationalist ideology that underpins that state. Zionism is not Judaism. Let me say that again for the people up top. Zionism is not Judaism. Right? It's a very modern, secular, political ideology movement that was founded less than 150 years ago by an atheist named Theodor Herzl, who said, and I quote, "The anti-Semites will be our most dependable friends, the anti-Semitic countries, our allies." His words, not mine. Number two, if you vote for this motion, you're throwing Palestinians as a people under the bus. You're telling an occupied people, a dispossessed people, to accept their own occupation, their own dispossession, meekly, in silence. Otherwise, they're racists. As my friend Yusuf Manaya, the Palestinian-American activist, says, to ask Palestinians not to be anti-Zionist is to ask Palestinians not to be. And number three, last but not least, if you vote for this motion, you're throwing a lot of Jews under the bus as well. Not just Jews like Edwin Samuel Montague, but Jews today. If you vote for this motion tonight, you're saying my debate partner, Gideon Levy, whose grandparents were killed in the Holocaust, who served for Shimon Peres, who's written for Haaretz for over 40 years, just won Israel's top journalism prize 3 years ago, he's an anti-Semite. You're saying the Satmar, the world's biggest Hasidic Jewish sect, which says it is fighting God's war against Zionism, is anti-Semitic. You're saying Jewish college students on campus, maybe some of them are your kids, members of If Not Now and Jewish Voices for Peace, they're anti-Semites. You're saying some of the most respected Jewish voices in the world, like Avraham Berg, the former Speaker of the Parliament, Miriam Margolis, the actress from Harry Bloody Potter, they're all anti-Semites. That is what you are saying. That is what you're signing off on if you vote for this motion tonight. So I have a simple solution for you all. Don't do it. Vote instead for common sense, for free speech, and the right to criticize a foreign country. The right to criticize a foreign country and a political ideology. I beg to oppose.
That was Mehdi Hassan. Next up, we have Professor Jeffrey Sachs, a professor at Columbia University in New York, is going to explain the use of the term the deep state, and also he's going to talk about the war in Ukraine.
Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Oh, good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, I've known about your work for a long time. I went to NYU. My sister went to Columbia. I have friends that went up to Columbia. So, and I know people that work there. So, but I've always associated you with development economics and developmental economics and climate change. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're talking about today's foreign policy. But just briefly, what's your background? How did you get into economics? How did you begin your work in public policy?
Well, I've been doing what I'm doing in one way or another for 44 years now. As a kid in high school, my parents took us abroad, and I got fascinated in how the world is rather strange and needs figuring out. I visited the Soviet Union during high school on a family trip. Met a pen pal who lived in East Berlin, visited him after high school, decided I really needed to understand the world a lot better than I did. I grew up in the US Midwest, just outside of Detroit, and the world seemed fascinating to me. So I started in college at Harvard College, studying economics, fell in love with the subject. After graduating from college, I went back to East Germany, learned a bit more, became completely fascinated in the question of what we call in economics comparative economics. Why do different parts of the world live differently? Why are some places rich, others poor? Who's got the best economic system? All of these questions fascinated me already more than 50 years ago. And I've basically continued in that track. I got my PhD at Harvard. I joined the faculty as an assistant professor. They were very kind. They promoted me each year up to full professor. So at a quite young age, I was a senior professor at Harvard. And I was invited to start working on real economic problems in countries that were in crisis, starting in South America, where I worked on and helped to solve what we call a hyperinflation. A hyperinflation is an inflation, everybody knows what that is, but so rapid that the prices are rising by thousands of percent per year. And I helped Bolivia to stop a hyperinflation in 1985. When you do that, you also get involved in foreign policy. You also get involved in international relations because economies don't just operate on their own. They operate in a political world within a country, but they operate in an international geopolitical world as well. Well, I didn't know that I was doing geopolitics exactly in 1985, but I began to do so. I got invited to a number of other countries. In 1989, a most remarkable thing happened for me. I was invited by the Polish government to help them on their economic crisis. It was a communist government, and I told them I couldn't really help them because one of my heroes, Lech Wałęsa, the head of Solidarity in Poland, was under house arrest. So I would like to help, but I can't really help under such political conditions. The gentleman said to me that he understood, and I said, please call me if anything changes. Well, 4 weeks later, he called, said, we're going to end the martial law. We're going to release Mr. Wałęsa. We're going to start negotiations with the Solidarity movement. And I scurried right over to Poland, and I said I would help to advise both the government and the opposition. Then came elections for the first time in Central Europe in 45 years. Suddenly, I was the main outside advisor of the first post-communist government as the Iron Curtain was falling. And I helped them through their economic and political and geopolitical labyrinth, and things worked out quite well. And from there, Mikhail Gorbachev's team called me, said, help us. Soviet Union's got lots of trouble. And so I started working with the economic team of President Gorbachev. Then, of course, as people know, the Soviet Union came to an end. And President Yeltsin's team said, help us. And I said, okay, I will work with you. And I spent a number of years around the region of Russia, Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, which became Czech Republic, and Slovakia, Slovenia, and many, many other places, and became rather deeply involved in the politics and the geopolitics of Central Europe, Eastern Europe, and the former Soviet Union. Now, from there, I was invited to come to Africa, which I had not worked in. I began to visit China and India regularly. I was asked by both governments to give advice in both China and in India. And in Africa, I began a very intensive period for me of 20 years of working on the challenges facing the poorest countries in the world. Well, at that point, the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, said, come be my advisor. And I said, great. And I packed up our bags. The family moved from Harvard, where I was professor, to Columbia University. I came in 2002. I came in a dual capacity as special advisor to the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, and as head of a rather remarkable innovation of Columbia University called the Earth Institute, which was focused not only on the economics issues that I had spent my career to that point working on, but the challenges of climate change and technology transformation and so forth. So it expanded my outlook, the questions that I was asking my colleagues, because suddenly I was a director of an institute with hundreds of climate scientists, including a unit of NASA. So it was really quite interesting, quite extraordinary. And I headed the Earth Institute for 14 years, from 2002 to 2016. I served as special advisor for three secretaries general, Kofi Annan, Ban Ki-moon, and Antonio Guterres. I continue to be a senior advisor of the United Nations. I've now worked in more than 140 countries, so I've seen the world from all different perspectives. And I suppose that that's what draws me more and more to geopolitics right now. Because when you've seen the world not only from the perspective from New York looking out or from Washington looking out, but from Moscow looking across the Atlantic or from Beijing looking across the Pacific or from Nairobi, in Kenya and so forth, you see things in a very different perspective. And that, I suppose, describes where I am today, not a US-centered view, but what I hope to be a kind of world-centered view that tries to understand how the different places in the world fit together.
So my outline for this discussion already was too long for the amount of time. Normally we do 2 hours, but now, I mean, listeners can hear that there are a lot of places that we could go. I wish we could even just linger on the 1990s, because as I mentioned, I was a student in the early 2000s at NYU. I didn't mention the date, but many of my professors in political science and a lot of the people I've met over the years were diplomats or people in positions of political power during that period who were also at a mature stage in their careers. And I don't know that one can overestimate the psychological impact that the collapse, and I would argue sudden collapse of the Soviet Union, because it really was very sudden at the time that it was experienced by people that wrote about it. In retrospect, people say that it was inevitable, but at the time it seemed to have shocked a lot of folks.
Can I tell you two anecdotes that, you know, two of the most amazing moments of my life? But because I was witness in the front row to this unbelievable revolution that was underway, just after June 4, 1989, Poland had these semi-free elections because it wasn't entirely open democracy yet. It was in a transition from communism to democracy. And in these partially free elections, the Solidarity Movement basically won every seat that was contested. And soon after that election, I sat down with one of the most senior people who became the foreign minister of Poland, actually. But at that point, he was just an opposition figure. But Solidarity had won all the contested seats. And he asked me what should be done. And I said, well, you have to form the new government. And he said, what are you talking about? We can't form the government. We're in, you know, communist-dominated Poland. I said, no, you just had elections. You need to form the new government. And he said, no, we can't anyway. The crisis is so deep, it's going to be explosive. We'll try to hold this communist regime to account, but we can't really manage this. I said, no, yes, you can manage it. I have some ideas. We're going to get your debt canceled. We're going to get a fresh start for you and so forth. Well, we discussed this for several hours. At the end, he stood up very forlorn and said, Mr. Sachs, I feel so bad because I think you are right. And that was, okay, we're going to have to move to some political leadership here faster than we anticipated. So that's how the first post-communist government started to take shape. And in fact, little known fact, but I watched it close up, Mikhail Gorbachev actually helped Solidarity get into the government in Poland. Then just fast forward 2.5 years, 1991, December, I'm invited to head a small delegation of economists to the Kremlin to meet with President Boris Yeltsin, who's president of Russia, but there still is the Soviet Union. This is December 1991, the last days, literally, of the Soviet Union. So we were sitting there in a huge room in the Kremlin. We were across a table, and President Yeltsin had not arrived. And then way in the back of this enormous cavernous room, the door opens, and in walks President Yeltsin from the far end of the room. And he walks in a big stride up to the chair directly in front of me because I was heading this small delegation. He sat down and he said, gentlemen, I would like to tell you that the Soviet Union has just ended. Those were the first words, remarkable, literally, out of translation, of course, but those were his first words. And then he pointed to the door in the distant back of the room. He said, do you know who I was meeting with in the next room? I was meeting with the leaders of the Soviet military, and they have just agreed to the end of the Soviet Union. And I heard this directly, just like that, from President Yeltsin. So these were absolutely extraordinary days.
So Dr. Sachs, I want to make the best use of our time possible, and maybe I can convince you at the end of the conversation to come back, because there are sort of two major categories that I've identified in the course of constructing an outline for this conversation. One was to kind of zoom out and understand your central critique of U.S. foreign policy and what you call and what others call American exceptionalism as it pertains to international affairs. And that would lead to a conversation about the national security state, the CIA, and Schlesinger's imperial presidency. The other part is to understand your critique of U.S. foreign policy in the post-Cold War era, and specifically as it pertains to Ukraine, and then also to understand your larger conception of the international system. I think the reason why this is really important, and I want to emphasize this with listeners, is that there are not many opportunities, in my opinion, to have conversations with thoughtful critics of American foreign policy. There are lots of voices, critical voices out there, but I don't find most of them to be particularly convincing. We have had conversations with folks like John Mearsheimer in the past, or my former professor of Soviet history, Stephen Cohen, but we don't have as many as I would like, and this is going to be an opportunity to do that. So we might not get into really as much of a conversation about Ukraine as I would like, but let's start with your main critique or set of critiques of American foreign policy. What are those, and how far back does one need to go in order to capture the totality of the strategic blunder that you've been describing in your recent writings and interviews?
Well, these two issues of American exceptionalism and the post-Cold War and how we find ourselves in a in an outright war with Russia right now, because we are at war. The United States has personnel on the ground that are providing the intelligence and manning the missiles that Ukraine is using to attack Russia. That's us there. The Russians know it too. We're neck deep into this, and it's extremely dangerous because the United States has 6,000 nuclear warheads, and so does Russia. And we're in a shooting match right now that really terrifies me, I have to say. So these issues are conjoined. They're actually the same kind of issue. And my critique is that basically the U.S. is too arrogant the way our government works. It is doesn't listen to other countries. It thinks that we always know best. It thinks, this is the security state I'm speaking of, not the American people who don't have much say in this, but the security state thinks, well, we're so powerful, we can do what we want. Now, let me quickly add a caveat. Things are changing very fast because things aren't working out the way America wants. So there's a very steep learning curve that's taking place right now. People are, even in the security state, are understanding, gee, that unipolar moment, that idea that we were the world's sole superpower and so forth, we have to rethink that. So the critique that I'm making is a critique that I've been making for a long time. I wrote a book several years ago before the Ukraine war and its current variant was underway, called A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism, because I already felt our arrogance was very dangerous. It's become a lot more dangerous, but also people are beginning to understand that that exceptionalism is also filled with the kind of blinders that are leading us astray. So where does this all come from? Well, I think probably most major powers in history, by the time they become major powers, are pretty proud of themselves and think that their culture or their god or their religion or their technologists or whatever happens to be the particular approach of the observer has vindicated their country as a natural leader. And you would see this in any empire of the past, that this is God-given, it proves God's on our side, or our gods are on our side, or whatever the claim has been made. And in this sense, the U.S. is no different from other major powers of the past. In fact, I like to say, and I deeply believe, that we've learned almost everything about being an empire from Britain, which was the dominant power in the world from roughly 1800 to roughly 1945, but one could quibble with the decades a little bit. But in any event, yes, Britain thought itself masters of the world, and in some ways it was in the 19th century. It was the first country to industrialize. It had an economy that just dominated the world, and it was able to beat the heck out of just about everyone that it tried to beat the heck out of in the 19th century. Now, for the United States, we've kind of had that view throughout our long history. The self-image that the U.S. is the city on the hill, a phrase made popular again by Ronald Reagan in an inspiring presidential speech. The idea that America is exceptional was part of our founding. But then America, you know, spent two centuries at war. We don't really think of it this way, but it was some genocides and some brutal wars across the American continent of defeating native populations, which were nations and had large territories, which we beat them out of over especially the 19th century. And then at the end of the 19th century, in 1898, we had taken over the continent. And almost immediately, the feeling of Teddy Roosevelt and McKinley was, okay, now we expand into the oceans. Now we take the empire in Hawaii. Now we beat the heck out of the waning, faltering, dying Spanish empire. So we take Puerto Rico, we take Cuba in our hemisphere, and we take the Philippines on the other side of the planet. That was 1898 in the Spanish-American War. And America joins about 100 years after, joins the European imperial powers, who have already been transoceanic powers. America's a very late comer to this, but God, what a booming economy. With a continental scale economy, huge technological innovations, the wonderful discovery of mass public education, so many things going for the United States, so much natural resource base filled with coal, oil, gas, everything one needs for greatness of military power, of technology, of industry, and so forth. And America does become the dominant economy already in the early 20th century, but not the dominant geopolitical force. But the idea that, oh, we're great, we're really something, is of course bolstered by all of this. Then, I'm speeding history very quickly, but two world wars, Great Depression, and lo and behold, by 1945, Britain is no longer an empire. It's exhausted. It's collapsed. India is about to declare its independence. Within a couple of decades, Britain loses almost all of its imperial possessions that have been conquered over the preceding couple of centuries. And America finds itself essentially as the unrivaled power of the world, but for the Soviet Union, which is much weaker economically and technologically, but militarily is a major, major power and a nuclear superpower, of course. So that begins the Cold War era. Now, there's a fateful expression that to me changed America because it's so self-flattering. I think it went to our heads, actually, almost in a literal sense. And that's when Henry Luce, the publisher of Time and Life, said, this is the American century, when he said it in 1941. Oh my God, you swoon over that phrase. And it's a wonderful phrase, and it was true. It felt so incredible, American century. He didn't mean a good century for America. He meant the century that America would govern the world, essentially. And that became the mindset after 1945. Not all wrong, by the way. America was a superpower militarily, technologically, economically, financially, culturally, you name it. America was a superpower. And I personally love more than any other president of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, who guided the country through the Great Depression and who guided the country through World War II and who invented the United Nations. And who set America on the course of global leadership. So there was this very optimistic sense, this is the American century and we will guide the world. And America did many wonderful things in the early days. It created the UN, it created UN institutions, it launched the World Health Organization, it launched UNESCO, and the UN Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization. It did many wonderful things. It helped to inaugurate an era of open trade, which made it possible for other countries to follow along in economic development. So that was the good side. The other side, though, was we entered a Cold War, kind of in a crusading spirit. We could talk for hours, days, sure, weeks, months, and years about the Cold War, and I'm going to restrain myself except to say, I think it could have been avoided. I think it could have been ended much sooner, but it was viewed as the great twilight struggle, to use the famous phrase of John F. Kennedy. After several decades that were extremely dangerous and we came close to blowing up the world in the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. The Soviet Union in the second half of the 1980s was exhausted and needed fundamental reform. And a young reformer, Mikhail Gorbachev, came to the forefront almost miraculously. And the main point about Mikhail Gorbachev was he was a man of peace beyond anything else. He was a great patriot. He was a socialist. He believed in socialism. But he was a man of peace. He said, I'm not going to shoot our opposition. And the Soviet Union basically could not hold together other than through force. And so this was the demise of the Soviet Union. Now, just to say, here's where the critique comes in of the next 30 plus years. I was there. I was an advisor to Gorbachev. I was an advisor to Yeltsin. I was an advisor to the second president of Ukraine, Leonid Kuchma. I loved Gorbachev's idea, which was now a world of peace. And he called it a common European home that would stretch from Rotterdam on the North Sea all the way across Eurasia to Vladivostok. And he saw that as a peaceful zone and an integrated economic zone. And I love that vision and I love it till today. But what I can tell you in short is the US deep state, that means the CIA, the National Security Apparatus, the Pentagon, the White House. I know these organizations, not every one of them, intimately and so forth, but I watched all of this quite close up. They didn't say, oh, we have had the hand of peace extended, let us cooperate. They really said, oh, we defeated our foe. Now we are the only power in the world. We can do what we want. And this initiated an era called neoconservatism. It really was started in the last year of the Bush Senior White House in 1992. And it was really started, you can pinpoint it, by the Secretary of Defense, Richard Cheney, who of course went on to become vice president under George W. Bush Jr., and his deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. And they already in 1992 said, we're it. We're the only superpower in the world. Our grand strategy as a nation is to remain completely unchallenged, what came to be called full spectrum dominance in every part of the world. So we have to be militarily the dominant, economically the dominant, financially the dominant, technologically the dominant. We need to dominate. And that is the foreign policy that we have had since 1992. So it's 32 years running. I've been a critic of it those 32 years because I've said, and maybe this sounds strange and counterintuitive, but I've said, don't declare victory of the Cold War, rather declare peace with our counterparts. Don't rub their face in it. As Churchill said, in victory, magnanimity, and in peace, goodwill, not conquest. But I watched close up something that Wesley Clark told us about. Wesley Clark was the NATO commander during the Clinton administration. We became friends after that, though we didn't see eye to eye on foreign policy often. But Wesley Clark told a story about walking into the Pentagon he tells it two times, but one is in 2001 after 9/11. And he's told, yeah, we're going to go to war several times because we're going to take out every one of America's enemies. We're going to not just address Al-Qaeda and what's just happened to us after 9/11, but we're going to take out Saddam. We're going to take out Muammar Gaddafi. We're going to take out all of Russia's would-be allies because we are the United States of America.
So,
And so, yeah, sorry. So
no,
we
it's okay.
launched a lot of wars of choice, and this is what has gotten us into a colossal mess. And every war of choice, I've been a public critic of it, strongly saying, we don't need this war. It's going to hurt us. We're not going to win. We're going to spend trillions of dollars. We're going to get a lot of people killed. And it's not going to help the United States. It's going to hurt the United States. It's going to make the world more dangerous.
So again, so much to respond to. First of all, for people that are curious about this history that you talk about, I think maybe the best articulation of the imperial agenda you described by the new conservatives was Bill Kristol's Project for a New American Century. His father, Irving, was the founder of the new conservative movement in the 1970s. And also another scholar who I studied in college who wrote a book called American Empire. His name is Andrew Bacevich. He's written many books. In that book, he talks about full spectrum dominance, which was really a compelling theory at the time. I think there's something to be said about the lingering framework of full spectrum dominance and the danger that it poses, because it could cause certain foreign policy thinkers to overreach, thinking that we have powers that we no longer have. I'm just trying to think about where I want to go here. So one of the things I like to
Could
do
I
on the
mention
show,
something
I just
just
want to
to,
say something.
oh,
Well,
sure.
sure. I just want to make sure, because again, we have limited time and we'll only get this to a little bit of what I wanted to talk about, but I want to try to at least complete some thoughts here or complete some questions and have you answer them. One of the things I'd like to do on the show is give people frameworks. And you mentioned the deep state. This is a what's challenging with words like the deep state is they become profuse in American culture and language, and yet no one really has a clear definition for what it is. Now, that may be by design in a sense, because it's very difficult to wrap your arms around something like this. But to the extent that we can, first of all, is there anyone who you presume has a complete picture of the deep state? And to the extent that you really understand what this is, how would you describe it? What is the schema that you would give people?
The deep state for me is the national security apparatus. And I believe that the most important institution in it is the Central Intelligence Agency and the intelligence agencies more generally. I think a tremendous amount of U.S. policy is made in the intelligence communities, which were designed, unfortunately, back in 1947 under the National Security Act. Not so much as intelligence agencies as almost a secret army of the President of the United States. So, a great deal of what the deep state has done over the decades is topple other governments. Typically, this is done in what are called covert regime change operations. It's sometimes overt, like sending in NATO to bomb Libya in 2011, but mostly it's done covertly. And there's a wonderful book that was a dissertation, actually, under John Mearsheimer by Lindsay O'Rourke called Covert Regime Change. It's really worth reading. It's stunning because she studies just the period 1947 to 1989, because, as she says at the beginning, she wanted to study a period where there's been a lot of declassification of documents. Not that covert regime change stopped then, but rather she wanted to be able to examine documents. And she records during the period 1947 to 1989, 70 regime change operations, 64 of which are covert. Now, what is a covert operation? It's pretty weird because when a government's overthrown, you know it. A covert operation isn't really a secret. What it means is the CIA denies it. It's not us, it's somebody else. But of course, the US is very deeply involved in it. I've seen some of this very close up. I know other bits of it by reading about it, studying about it, talking to people who were involved. But it's a pervasive part of our foreign policy. And that's basically what the deep state does. Now, who are the institutions? It is a small group, but I could not tell you whether it's unchanged administration to administration, but it's the president, it's the National Security Council, it's the intelligence agencies, it's the Pentagon, It is a very small number of major military contractors, and it's the Armed Services Committees of the Congress. That is a few hundred people, they are the main determinants of the American use of violence, whether in covert means or decisions on going to war.
So again, we could linger here forever. There's a great book that I read years ago by Tim Weiner called Legacy of Ashes, which I think is a quote of Dwight D. Eisenhower's when he was reflecting on the CIA. There's criticisms of that book, of course, because it goes into so many details. Some people say, is Tim Weiner just an agent of the CIA? Because one of the contentions of the book was that this agency has been a total disaster. And so because it's shrouded in secrecy by design, a lot of rumors persist about it that no one can really verify one way or the other. Another problem with the, quote, deep state or national security state or the CIA or the national security apparatus is that much of what the public knows, at the very least, right, is stuff that's very old, stuff that's been released over time. And so I guess one question I have here is, how much do you think what we know about what the CIA was in 1963 when Harry Truman wrote his critique of the organization in the Washington Post a month after Kennedy was assassinated, how much of what we understand about the intelligence apparatus is actually relevant to how it operates today and how much power the agencies have today?
I think it's still very relevant, and it's completely shocking and dismaying to me that the last time there was a serious investigation by Congress of the CIA was 1975, the Church Committee of Frank Church of Idaho. That was 50 years ago this coming year. We've not had a serious investigation since then. Now, I've seen some coups straight up with my own eyes. Because I work abroad, I had a president tell me, they're going to take me out. And they did, by the way.
A president tell you that they're going to take him out, not take you out.
No, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not me. First of all,
You're talking about the Haitian president.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So the president of Haiti, Aristide, said to me, thank you. You got it exactly right. They're going to take me, President Aristide, out. And I, being a naive economist, said, no, we're going to get this to work. We'll fix this and so on. One day they walked him to an unmarked plane and overthrew him and flew him to the Central African Republic. They literally did it. And then I got this unbelievable glimpse into how this works when, horrified, I called the New York Times reporter on the beat of Haiti and said to her, report this, come on, it's broad daylight. She said to me, this is a friend, oh no, my editor's not interested in this. Excuse me? Your editor is not interested in an American-led coup in broad daylight? And that's how it went down. Now, that's just little Haiti, but that's how it went down. And I've seen lots of this over the years, not in a systematic way. No one's sharing this information with me. I'm an economist. I'm dealing with budgets and taxes and exchange rates. But you hear a lot because I'm dealing with heads of state and I'm dealing with foreign ministers and I'm dealing with economy ministers and so on. And we're meddling up and down the wazoo, and it's extremely dangerous. And the track record of all of this is terrible, because if you overthrow another country, you don't end up in a new equilibrium. You end up in a profound disorientation. And just to take another case, because you're right, the American people know very little about this. We know very little about it. It's all secret. So you just get glimpses of it. But another example, Obama decided, together with Hillary Clinton, that they would overthrow the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. And the president made what's called a finding, presidential finding, and he ordered the CIA to train and arm jihadists, basically, to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. And they did that, but they didn't succeed, as in many cases, they failed. Now, this was all denied for years. And then there were two, I think, maybe three times that this was mentioned in the New York Times in 2015 and 2016. It's called Operation Timber Sycamore. It's a real document, a real plan. It's, you know, something really signed by the President of the United States. But the American people aren't told almost anything. Okay, one day the New York Times ran one page about it, said it didn't work. But my God, you know, if you try to overthrow another government, frankly, I'd like the American people to understand. That's how Syria got into such a prolonged chaos. And then what happened, by the way, which is par for the course, after several years, Russia came in on the side of Assad. And when Russia came in, we attacked Russia for meddling in the internal affairs of Syria. So it's called gaslighting. It was pure gaslighting. It purely phony. And that I happen to know because I knew people very much involved in the whole episode. I heard an earful about the U.S. machinations during that period.
So again, we're not going to have a chance to get into any of that. I wish, again, I hope that I can convince you to come on to talk about all of that. There's another book I want to recommend for listeners. It's called Active Measures by Thomas Ridd. And it only came to me now because you're talking about how we don't really know. And that's by design. The book Active Measures is actually about the Soviet KGB intelligence apparatus and how it operated and by design created this environment of uncertainty, even within its own ranks. And that has a really pernicious effect on a society. And similarly, the cult of secrecy that we have in the United States has been too. I want to propose a theory to you, and I'm curious if it resonates. There are a lot of theories that have cropped up over the years about CIA or intelligence meddling operations. One is obviously the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. Another one is the attacks of 9/11. With respect to JFK's assassination, actually with both in these cases, there was suppression of information. And I know this is a fact for 9/11. We know this is a fact on the historical record for JFK. We also know it for 9/11, but I've also had Senator Bob Kerry, who was one of the 11 members of the 9/11 Commission on here. And he talked about how he actually said, quote, this was a conspiracy that went to the highest levels of the Saudi government, the Saudi royal family. And we've recently seen some videotape coming up again. Very odd. Why is this videotape recently surfacing of a Saudi diplomat casing the U.S. Capitol? My theory about all of these things is that because we have this sort of extrajudicious agency that exists outside the law, that has not just black ops budgets provided by the government, but also has its own revenue streams that it generates illegally and is able to use fund operations. Because of all this secrecy and because of how compromised so many people are as a result of how our government operates since the end of World War II, my sense is that people assume, for example, that a lot of people assume that Oswald killed Kennedy because he worked for the CIA and because of all the connections around him. But it's also perfectly possible that Oswald was a deeply compromised human being who went rogue, maybe thinking that it would please his handlers at the CIA, killed Kennedy. So the whole thing was suppressed because so many people were involved and people were also terrified, self-censored. You know, I remember listening to a phone call that Lyndon Johnson had with either Senator Warren or with Chief Justice Warren or with Gerald Ford, and one of the two or both didn't want the job because people were terrified. And I think the same is true for 9/11. We don't really know who was involved, where it crossed boundaries with the CIA, with the intelligence community, or anything else. Does that resonate with you?
Well, I've studied the Kennedy assassination at length, in part because I wrote a book about President Kennedy and his negotiation of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in 1963. So I got very much drawn into the subject. I'm personally convinced that there was a conspiracy, that the United States government was very much involved, that the CIA was involved, that papers are still being withheld, we know, that show a lot of what was known, because here we are 61 years later, and every president has withheld documents that were supposed to have been released a long time ago.
When you say the government was involved, do you mean a shadow government, a government, a sort of a, 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 a source of power that was filled with the ranks of people in the intelligence community, maybe people also within the official government, but not the official government itself.
We don't know. We really don't know. I think a lot of people who had government jobs were involved. Let me put it that way.
Right.
Whether it was crazy and rogue or a little bit more even structured than that, it was a coup, and it was a very awful thing. And aside from everything else, just as a footnote, because for all of us who spent a lifetime hearing about it, looking at Zapruder, reading about it, talking about it, the forensics for that never added up at all.
Yeah.
And so it's clearly there was bullshit from the very beginning in all of this. And what you see, by the way, is it's the collapse of the American public's confidence in government.
Yeah.
Starts then. It's the tragedy. It's what Bob Dylan says in Murder Most Foul. It was really the end of the illusion in a way.
Yeah. So JFK, another item we'll have to add to our list for when
absolutely.
We come back on the show. I'm going to actually end the conversation here, Dr. Sachs, because we're basically running up on the end of it. And I want to tell you sort of where I wanted to take this conversation and also to let listeners know as well in case we can continue it later.
Absolutely.
One area, obviously, this was just a prelude to the main act, which is really a conversation about post-Cold War politics, foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia. The question of, I don't really like the question of who lost Russia. It's a common one that people ask. I think it's actually a malformed question. But I think it's one way to think about kind of where I want to take this conversation, which is how much is this, quote, America's fault? Because I think part of this, I think, is just the result that in America, people talk about America. It's just natural. But there's a kind of weird sense in which everything that goes wrong in the world is America's fault. But somehow like we're incredibly incompetent. But at the same time, everything that happens, any kind of, coup is America's tentacles somewhere. And again, I think this also speaks to what we talked about earlier, which is this the immense power that's grown up around the executive. The quote, deep state, people have lost confidence. They don't know what is real and what's not real. And this is really problematic. And again, I actually want to quote another great book by Peter Pomerantsev called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. It's actually about post-Soviet propaganda and how propaganda works in Russia. But it's actually something that reflects increasingly how American society is organized informationally these days. But I just want to highlight, some of the things that I want to talk to you about is one, the argument about NATO enlargement. Mm-hmm. as the reason for the war in Ukraine. And I wanted to get specifically into that, just enlargement overall, reunification of Germany. I just kind of wanted to understand the scope of your thinking there.
Great.
I also wanted to talk about the withdrawal, the unilateral withdrawal from the ABM Treaty in 2002, as well as the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in 2018, and then also all the provocations with respect to Ukraine. And I think there is a really great opportunity to not just bring in conversations about the intelligence community, but also the messy job of trying to understand really how the United States interfaces with the world. I mean, there are a lot of companies and NGOs that have their own ideas, and those things spread internationally. And I don't know to what extent it was NATO itself that created a security dilemma for Putin. Certainly there are geopolitical arguments for why NATO expansion would be problematic for Russia, but to what extent was it really a Russian issue? To what extent was it really a Putin issue? And it was much more about the westernization of Ukraine that made him nervous, just like the westernization of Taiwan and other Asian countries might make China nervous because perhaps it undermines their sense of confidence in the staying power of their regimes.
All great questions. Yeah. I look forward to continuing. These really are great questions and very important ones. And let's spend some time on them.
Yeah. And we'll have a chance also to talk about I have a section here called President Sachs, and I wanted to understand sort of.
Oh, my God. No,
because you do a great job in your book, actually, of what I love about also your book on new foreign policy is that you spend quite a bit of time talking about, OK, so here's what's wrong. Here, how do we address those problems? I think that's super important. I think as Americans, we want to be constructive in how we engage with politics and our future. And so I appreciate that. And I hope that you will come back on and maybe we can do it soon to talk about all of these things, Dr. Sachs. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Really a pleasure. Great to be with you. And yes, let's do some more. Thanks.